Welcome to today's deep dive. We have got a massive topic today for you. We are unpacking a completely fascinating 2023 study by Xiangwei Liu and their whole research team.
Yeah, it's a really impressive piece of work.
It really is. And our mission today is to essentially map out the future of China's marine food supply under the pretty relentless pressure of climate change. So, you know, we're not just looking at some niche science paper today.
Right. Not yet.
We are staring directly at the mechanics of global food security. I mean, you've probably seen the headlines about warming oceans, but the Liu study goes like light years beyond those broad, generic, global guesses.
Right. They get incredibly granular with the data.
Exactly. Okay, let's unpack this, because what they did was build this highly specific physical and biological simulation, and they mapped out the fates of 14 distinct marine species in Chinese waters across the entire 21st century.
Yeah, and to really grasp why this specific simulation matters so much, you kind of have to look at the sheer staggering scale of the present operation over there.
Oh, absolutely. The numbers are wild.
They really are. I mean, as of 2020, China accounts for 58% of the world's entire aquaculture animal production.
Wait. 58% of the entire world's production?
Yeah. More than half of all the farmed seafood on the planet is driven by just one nation's infrastructure. And the trajectory is steep, you know. Over the last 30 years, China's mariculture has increased eightfold.
Eightfold. That is just, I mean, that's explosive growth.
It is. And it now actually produces more than double the volume of the country's wild capture fisheries.
You know, that feels like a very deliberate pivot, right? A government capping wild capture to protect those natural marine ecosystems from being totally overfished. And instead, you know, relying on this massive farmed engine to provide protein for billions of people.
That's exactly what it is. It's a massive shift in how they feed the population.
But wait, when we say mariculture, we aren't just talking about indoor tanks or freshwater ponds, right? Because I think that's what a lot of people picture.
No, that's a crucial distinction. We are talking about the open ocean and coastal environments.
Okay, so like the South China Sea, the East China Sea, the Yellow Sea.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Bohai Sea. This is a factory without a roof. The infrastructure is completely exposed to the elements out there.
Wow. So they are completely at the mercy of whatever the ocean does.
Right. And that vulnerability, that open ocean exposure, is really the driving question of the Liu study. Mm. These organisms are living out in the natural marine environment. They don't have climate-controlled warehouses.
Yeah, you can't exactly adjust the thermostat on the East China Sea.
Exactly. So if the global climate swings wildly, the entire food production system is just forced to absorb that shock.
Which is terrifying when you think about it. I mean, I can barely trust a weather app's 10-day forecast, you know?
Yeah.
So how do Liu and his team actually mathematically project the biological growth of a fish or a scallop like 70 years from now in an environment that chaotic? Biology is messy.
It is super messy. But they manage that complexity by using what's called a dual model approach. They essentially layered two totally different engines of data on top of each other.
Okay, two engines. Walk me through the first one.
So the first is a physical model, and this basically just looks at the strict environmental limits of the ocean itself. Using data from big global climate models, they mapped out future ocean depth, dissolved oxygen levels, and chlorophylla concentration.
Chlorophylla? That's like plant stuff, right?
Yeah, it's the proxy they use for phytoplankton, which is the absolute base of the food web.
Oh, gotcha. So it's basically tracking how much food will be in the water.
Precisely. And they also tracked ocean acidification by projecting future pH levels. So putting all that together, they created this dynamic map of where the water will remain physically habitable.
Okay, so the first model establishes the real estate. It tells you, you know, what the physical neighborhood looks like in 2050 or 2090.
Right, the physical boundaries.
Yeah.
And once that neighborhood is established, they introduce the second engine, which is the biological growth model.
Okay, and what does that one do?
This one tracks how an individual species-specific organism actually physically grows when it's subjected to those shifting environmental conditions we just talked about.
Oh, wow. So it's basically like they built a complex video game simulation of the ocean, dropped 14 virtual species into it, and then hit fast forward while randomly adjusting the global thermostat.
That is a perfect analogy, yeah. That's exactly what they did. And to see the full spectrum of possibilities, they ran these models through two very distinct climate scenarios from the UN's climate panel.
Right, the SSP scenario.
Yeah, specifically SSP 5 8.5 and SSP 1 2.6. And they tracked these from a historical baseline, which was roughly 2005 to 2014, all the way through mid-century around the 2050s, and then to a late century time frame in the 2090s.
Okay, we hear those SSP acronyms thrown around a lot in climate science, so let's ground those in reality for you listening. SSP 5.8.5 isn't just an arbitrary high temperature setting on a dial. It represents a very specific socioeconomic path.
A very fossil fuel heavy path.
Right. It's a development model where the global economy grows rapidly, but we completely fail to curb our greenhouse gas emissions. It's essentially the, you know, business as usual, burn it all scenario.
Unfortunately, yes.
Whereas SSP 1.2.6 is the green road. It's a highly sustainable pathway where global policies shift, renewable energy takes over, and we actively mitigate our carbon output.
Exactly. And putting these virtual marine species into those two opposing scenarios is what makes the biological modeling in this study so incredibly robust.
Because it shows us the extremes.
Right. And the way they actually modeled the biology is fascinating. Like for the finfish, so think of the grouper or the rainbow trout, they use what are called thermal performance curves, or TPCs.
Thermal performance curves. Okay, so temperature is the main factor there.
Yes. Growth for a finfish is primarily dictated by temperature. A TPC basically maps the efficiency of a fish's biological engine. So at a baseline, cold water slows down their enzymatic reactions, right? Their metabolism gets sluggish.
Makes sense. Cold fish, slow fish.
But as the water warms up, the enzymes work faster, and the fish eventually hits its optimal growth peak. It's like its Goldilocks zone.
But push the temperature just a degree or two past that peak, and the curve doesn't just like slowly slope down, right? It drops off a cliff.
It crashes completely. The proteins begin to denature, the fish enters thermal shock, and its growth potential just plummets.
Wow. So that thermal cleave is the big threat for the finfish.
It is. But bivalves, so the scallops, the oysters, the mussels, they require a completely different mathematical approach.
Because they don't just swim around and eat stuff.
Right. They are filter feeders.
Yeah.
So their growth isn't dictated by temperature alone. The researchers had to use a dynamic energy budget model. Or a DEB model.
DEB model. Okay, what is that?
Think of a DEB model as a strict financial accounting system, but for the organism's energy.
Oh, I love that. So tracking biological cash flow.
Exactly. The bivalve brings in income by filtering food from the water, which the model tracks via the concentration of that chlorophyll that we mentioned.
Right, the phytoplankton proxy.
But the bivalve also has mandatory expenses. It has somatic maintenance, which is literally just keeping its cells alive, followed by growth and reproduction.
Okay, so income and expenses. Where does climate change come in?
Well, as the water temperature rises, the baseline maintenance cost skyrockets. The bivalve is suddenly spending all its energy just trying to survive the heat.
Oh, man. So the expenses go way up.
And if the chlorophyll levels drop at the same time because the ecosystem is stressed, the income plummets.
So the organism essentially goes bankrupt. It has no surplus energy left to actually grow.
Bankrupt is the perfect word. And you also have to factor in ocean acidification, which is essentially the third rail for bivalves.
Because of their shells, right?
Yeah. When the ocean absorbs all that excess carbon dioxide under the SSP 5.8.5 high emission scenario, the overall pH drops. That chemical reaction binds up carbonate ions in the water.
Which means the bivalve has to spend significantly more of its already depleted energy budget just to extract the building blocks it needs to form its calcium carbonate shell.
Yes. It is a massive, hidden metabolic tax.
Wow.
This creates what we can call a triple threat for bivalves under the high emission scenario. You've got thermal stress driving up their maintenance costs. You've got erratic primary productivity reducing their food supply. And acidification taxing their shell creation.
That sounds brutal.
It is. Under SSP 5.8.5, the growth potential for bivalves just continuously declines throughout the entire 21st century. It is a very severe outlook.
Okay, so we have the models running. We understand the physiological stressors, the thermal performance curves, and the dynamic energy budgets. Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because when we look at the late century data under that fossil-fueled SSP 5.8.5 scenario, the impact is highly species-specific, isn't it? It's not a universal decline across the board.
No, not at all. It's like a total reshuffling of the deck.
Let's talk about the cold water species first, because they get hit hard.
They are devastated. The study really highlights the Yeso scallop P. yesovensis, which is a huge commercial species. By the late century, the simulation projects up to a 73.7% decrease in its potential culture area.
That's nearly three quarters of its viable farming habitat, just vanishing.
Completely gone. And the finfish aren't spared either. The omikis, which is the cold water rainbow trout, sees its individual growth potential plummet by 40.4%.
Just because the environment becomes too metabolically expensive for them to survive.
Exactly.
But the ocean doesn't just empty out, right? I mean, a marine ecosystem, even a heavily managed agricultural one, abhors a vacuum. So as the cold water species collapse and their farming zones become unviable, the warm water species step into that newly heated real estate and actually thrive.
They do. Species like the grouper specifically, Epinephilus spp. Hay,
yeah,
and the red drum, S. oscillatus, they actually see a significant boost.
Wait, really? A boost under the high emission scenario?
Yeah. The red drum sees up to a 16.1% increase in growth potential by the late century under high emissions.
That's wild. So for them, it's a good thing.
Well, temporarily, yes. Because the water temperatures in areas that used to be far too frigid for them are now entering their optimal enzymatic Goldilocks zone.
Okay, but this triggers what I think is the most massive physical disruption predicted by the LU study, the geographic shift. The high-growth centroid, you know, the prime optimal location for this massive mariculture industry, it migrates dramatically northward.
Yes, the map completely changes.
The East and South China Seas, which currently act as the absolute powerhouses of this aquaculture engine, lose a massive amount of their viability because the water just becomes lethally hot for their traditional species.
Right. And meanwhile, the Yellow Sea and the Bohai Sea, which are situated much further north, become the new premium real estate. They warm up just enough to support those warm water species that are moving up from the south.
But wait, if I'm a scallop attached to a rope in the South China Sea and the water gets too hot, I can't exactly pack my bags and swim hundreds of miles north to the Bohai Sea.
No, you can't.
The animals cannot migrate themselves. Does this mean entire regional economies are going to collapse?
What's fascinating here is that while the animals can't move, the farms themselves have to. The infrastructure literally has to be relocated.
Relocating an industry that produces over half the world's farmed seafood. I mean, that is an economic and logistical leviathan.
It's nearly unimaginable. Mm-hmm. And the transition up north is incredibly complex. Like the three northern provinces, Hebei, Liaoning, and Shandong, they currently account for roughly half of China's shellfish production.
Okay.
And the model clearly shows these regions will face massive disruptions.
Right. So they are taking on new warm water species moving up from the south, but their existing native bivalve industries are getting hammered by the ocean acidification and the temperature spikes we talked about earlier.
Exactly. It is a total ecological and economic scrambling of the map.
So if the geography of the ocean is fundamentally changing like that, humans can't just sit back and watch. How does the mariculture industry survive this shift? Facing a geographical scrambling of that magnitude requires some serious adaptation. They aren't just going to watch the water boil.
No, and they aren't. This study outlines several engineering and biological strategies that are already being deployed to kind of cheat these shifting climate boundaries.
Okay, what's the first strategy?
The most immediate geographic strategy is moving offshore. If the shallow coastal surface water is too hot and migrating further north just isn't feasible, you move outward and downward. You go into deeper waters where the thermal layers are more stable.
But farming in the deep open ocean is an extreme engineering challenge, right? I mean, you are dealing with massive wave action, brutal currents, and just the incredible logistical cost to service those farms with boats and personnel.
It absolutely pushes the boundaries of marine engineering. But the study cites some real operational examples. Most notably, a facility called Deep Blue One in the Yellow Sea.
Deep Blue One sounds like a sci-fi movie.
It kind of is. It's this large-scale deep-sea fence culture system, and it functions by taking advantage of a specific oceanographic feature known as a cold water mass.
Wait, what's a cold water mass?
It's basically a deep, naturally refrigerated pool of water that stays cool even when the surface gets hot.
Oh, so it's essentially exploiting a thermal inversion in the ocean.
Exactly.
While the surface water is warming to those dangerous metabolism crashing levels, Deep Blue One acts as a massive submerged enclosure dropped down into this cold pool. It creates a physical refuge to grow cold water salmonids despite the climate chaos happening like 100 feet above them.
Right. It's an incredible piece of adaptation. But beyond the mechanical engineering of these deep water bunkers, there is also biological engineering.
Like genetic modification.
More like selective breeding. The researchers point to selective breeding as a really crucial adaptation tool. Marine biologists have developed new, highly resilient strains of bivalves.
Oh, like what?
The most famous is the Zhangzidao Hong scallop strain. Through rigorous selective breeding, they have manipulated the genetics of the Yeso scallop to basically push its thermal performance curve outward.
So they shifted the Goldilocks zone.
Exactly. They created a variety that can handle temperature spikes and environmental stress far better than its natural wild counterparts.
That's amazing. So what does this all mean for you, the listener, picking up seafood at the grocery store? I mean, we're basically building giant underwater air-conditioned bunkers and breeding super scallops just to cheat the climate and keep seafood on the shelves.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, there is a hard biological ceiling to how far you can selectively breed an organism.
Right.
Or how many deep water cages you can physically afford to build. You cannot air condition the entire ocean. The engineering and the super scallops are really just buying the industry time.
Which brings us back to the most vital takeaway from the Luu study and why they ran those two separate climate scenarios in the first place. Everything we have discussed today, you know, the bankrupt energy budgets of the bivalves, the collapsing cold water populations, the massive migration of the industry northward, that entire chaotic cascade happens under SSP5 8.5.
Yes, that is a fossil-fueled high-emission reality.
But the SSP1 2.6 scenario provides a totally different counter-narrative, right?
It really does. Under that low-emission, sustainable pathway, where global society actively shifts its energy grid and curbs carbon output, the biological models tell a very different story.
A better story, I hope.
Much better. The growth potential for most finfish actually stabilizes. And while the bivalves still take a noticeable hit in the mid-century due to the baked-in warming we've already caused.
Because the ocean has already absorbed so much heat.
Right. But by the late 21st century, their dynamic energy budgets actually start to recover.
Oh, wow. They recover.
Yes. And the extreme disruptive northward shift of the entire industry is significantly blunted.
So the physical data proves that the ocean's ecosystems and the agricultural systems we have built within them actually retain the capacity to stabilize.
They do. But they can only do so if we relieve the overarching pressure of our emissions. Technological adaptation is a buffer. Mitigation is the only real cure.
That is perfectly stated. Well, we have mapped out the sheer scale of an industry that produces the majority of the world's farmed seafood. We've looked under the hood of these predictive models, exploring how thermal performance curves dictate the enzymatic life and death of finfish.
And how dynamic energy budgets force bivalves into metabolic bankruptcy when faced with heat and acidification.
Right. And we've seen how a high emissions future forces a massive geographic migration of these species northward, and how human ingenuity is fighting back with, you know, deep water thermal refuges and selectively bred super scallops. The data from the Luu study really just lays out the mechanics of our future food supply with incredible precision.
It does. But, you know, we've spent this entire deep dive looking at how thermal performance curves and energy budgets dictate the future of these marine species.
Yeah.
But there is an energy budget for human societies, too.
What do you mean?
Well, the physical habitats for these species are migrating across lines of latitude. As the fish move north, these massive aquaculture industries will eventually have to pack up their infrastructure and relocate to follow the cold water.
Right. The farms have to move.
So consider the southern coastal communities left behind. The cultural identities tied to the sea, the generational knowledge of farming-specific inlets, the economic lifeblood of entire regions.
Oh, man. That's a huge loss.
It's massive. If our food literally swims away to a new zip code, how do our human societies adapt to the empty water left behind?
That is a very heavy, very real question to leave off on. Something for all of you listening to Mull Over today. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.